Well, 2 weeks in a row on money. Boy, he's really getting out of hand. Yes, indeed. You know, the Bible's teaching about money is so extravagantly rich that it deserves many more than 4 weeks. It's been estimated that 1/4 of the verses that deal with Jesus' own teaching in the Gospels are about money. The very parables that Pete referred to a moment ago have so much to do with money. And my purpose in these weeks, as I've mentioned to you, is not to make you feel guilty. If I motivate you by guilt, I lose, you lose, we all lose. No, it is not to motivate you by guilt, although it's tempting. Thanks to John Hawkins, I can tell you a story this morning. There was this church, you know, that really knew how to motivate people by guilt in their giving. It's not our church, I guarantee you, because we do not keep computer records on exactly what your income is. We have no way of knowing what your income is. We barely keep up for IRS purposes with marking what it is that you give to the church so that we can give you a report as you're supposed to have legally on an annual basis. But there was a church that had this amazing computer program that could tell exactly what everyone in their church made on an annual basis. And they would compare that with their giving on an annual basis. And some of the stronger, stouter deacons would go visit people annually to ask for an accounting for the differences here between these two. And they went to this one man, they said, "Now, you have made an extraordinary income in the last 2 years, but it's not apparent that it shows at all in your giving." And he said, "Well, what the computer probably doesn't show is that a couple of years ago my mother was very ill and there's extraordinary hospital bills and I had to take care of those. And then last year my son was in great deal of difficulty legally and there was all kinds of legal defense bills that I had to pay. And well, if I didn't give them anything, I'm not going to give you anything." The object must never be guilt as we talk about money. But it can, and it should be, a sober respect for money. A sober respect for it. For its power, for its use, for the ways in which God in His kingdom intends for us to use it. And that's what I want us to speak about this morning. How we have a sober respect for what you could call the humility of money. For money humbles us. And actually, and I believe there are people in this room who could attest to this, the more of it that we have, actually, if money does its work in God's way in our hearts and lives, the more we're humbled. We all could say that we have met a person who is quite poor and they have an extraordinary dignity about them. In their humility, they have a dignity that poverty actually makes one humble and yet they have great dignity. What I'm after is people who have, certainly by any comparison that we could measure, an extraordinary amount of wealth and yet there is also that humility and that dignity about its use. There are three ways in which money can humble us, according to the passage that has been read in 1 Timothy chapter 6. You might want to open that in the Pew Bible, page 1154, or in your own Bible, or at least keep before you, please, the bulletin where those passages, those verses are written out. Three ways in which we see the work of money in our own hearts to humble us. Three ways in which money actually humbles us. The first is this. Money presents three distinct and often contrary challenges to us. three distinct and contrary challenges. One is earning money, getting it. The other is spending it. And the third is giving it. And the truth is that one who is good in one or two of those three aspects, those three challenges of the use of money, may not actually be good in the others. In other words, if you're good in earning money, you may not be good at spending or enjoying it. Or if you're good at enjoying money, you may not actually be good in giving it. In other words, different abilities are required in the total stewardship of money in our lives, and not everyone has all three. Colonel S.S. Slaughter was an oil baron, cattle baron, oil baron and cattle magnet in the early days of Texas. And his prayer, a wonderful godly man, and his prayer was, Lord, give me a hand to get and give me a hand to give. And if the Lord answered his prayer, which I suspect he did, I would tell you that he was fairly unusual. It is not every person who has a strong hand to get and a strong hand to give, and yet another ability as well to enjoy their wealth. Those are actually very distinct challenges. It takes one type of person to obtain wealth and another type to expend it. And the person who is actually capable of acquiring much, much wealth may not be the same person who is able to give it or to spend it well. One person, a multimillionaire in his own right, said it this way. He said, I wish I had two lives. I wish I had the life that is required to obtain money, and I wish I had the life that is required to spend money. Let me give you an illustration or two of the difficulties that these distinct challenges present us with. Say on the side of enjoying money. Anyone who has a lot of money will tell you that one of the distinct challenges of enjoying their money is restraint. That is, not buying everything their money can buy, but knowing how to make wise decisions that are actually restraining decisions where they don't do everything they can. Now, that may not be your problem, but it is the problem of many. Winston Churchill in the 1930s quoted Alexander the Great, who said that the reason the people of Asia were enslaved was because they never learned to say the word no. And the way Churchill used that was in reference to Western civilization, Western countries in the 1930s that were so busy appeasing Hitler that they failed to say no to Hitler and were, in Churchill's estimation, brilliantly, I must say, years before all of his contemporaries. He saw that if we did not say no to Hitler, we would be in danger of being enslaved by Nazism. The significance and power of saying no in your life, that's a challenge in every area. Just because you have the ability to do something does not mean you should do it. It takes a great deal of wisdom. Or take another challenge on this side, on the side of giving money, enjoying it, earning it, enjoying it, and giving it. Three challenges. What about giving it? Enormous challenge comes to us in knowing how to give. And we'll speak more about that. But just take these statistics to help prod our thinking. It has been shown that in the year 1989, the American family that had an income of $10,000 or less, which is not much of an annual income at all, is it? $10,000 or less, gave away 5.5% of its income to charity. The same year, families with over $100,000 income gave away 2.9% of their annual income to charity. What does that tell you? It may tell you many things, but don't take it too far too quickly. Don't run to greed or stinginess. Just stay with difficulty. It is difficult to know how to give money away. It's a very enormous challenge. Another statistic that's interesting in the same way. Between 1980 and 1988, those who made very large incomes, $500,000 or more, in 1980, they gave away an average of $46,320. By 1988, the same people with the same average income of over $500,000 gave away $16,032 annually. Huge decrease in a decade, which was the decade of plenty, the decade of enormous progress and growth. You see the difficulty? The difficulty of earning, the difficulty of spending, of enjoying, and the difficulty of giving. Distinct challenges that actually humble us. They humble us, and they should. How do I do it? How do I manage it? Not only how do I get it, but how do I spend it well? Miguel Cervantes in Don Quixote put it this way: what brings happiness to the possessor of wealth is not the having of it, but the spending of it. And by that I mean spending it well, and not simply to gratify our own whims. Spending money well. Arrogance, as Paul talks about it here in 1 Timothy 6, keeps us from spending money well, keeps us from enjoying it, keeps us from giving it. That's the first challenge. Money humbles us because it presents us with enormous challenges. The second point is that money humbles us particularly because of the difficulty of giving money away. Particularly now focusing on the third one of those, giving money away is extraordinarily difficult for a number of reasons. This is the way the Roman philosopher Seneca, the poet and philosopher of ancient Rome, put it this way: whoever believes that giving is an easy matter makes a mistake. It is a matter of very great difficulty, provided that gifts are made with wisdom and not scattered haphazardly or capriciously. There are, to my knowledge, no bestsellers on the market today about how to give away lots of money. It's very, very difficult. Yes, it is funny. Andrew Carnegie said it this way. He said, "It is well to remember that it requires the exercise of not less ability than that which acquired it to use wealth so as to really be beneficial to the community. It requires not less wisdom," Carnegie would say, "but it would require more." Why is giving so difficult? A number of reasons. Think of it this way. Giving requires dealing with the consequences of my gift to the one who receives it. Now, that may not seem like much of a challenge, but it is. There are, for example, often unforeseen issues that arise when I give money away, unintended and even ironic consequences to my giving money. For example, people can become dependent upon it. People can feel exploited even by our giving. One of the most remarkable examples of the ironic and unintended consequences of what would seem to be a very generous thing occurred to me in Manila almost 10 years ago when I was there for a World Missions Conference. And in Manila, one of the poorest cities in the world, there was this fabulously wealthy conference center and hotel site where we were meeting. But outside our hotel every day, there would line up these beautiful little Filipino girls, 7, 8 years old, and they were begging as we would go from the hotel to the convention center. And the first day or so of the convention, we gladly put in our little Philippine coins to try and help these little girls as we walked to and fro. But then they warned us in front of the whole convention, telling us that if we continued to give money to these little girls, we would turn them into street prostitutes. Absolutely unintended. And yet what we were doing was we were creating a dependency of these little girls upon the gifts of grown men. And you see where that goes and where it could go in their lives. So giving is difficult, has consequences for the one who receives. It also has consequences for the one who gives. We have to examine our motives for giving. And that becomes quite difficult. For example, if our motives for giving are out of a kind of self-interest, out of a desire to control or dominate people in our giving, maybe a sop for our conscience. If any of these things are actively working in our giving, the compromise is enormous. You see, it's one thing to use our checkbook in giving, it's another thing to use our conscience in giving. And so often we have to be careful that we're not giving for entirely the wrong motives. Giving is difficult. Or here's an odd one for you, and I actually know a number of you who struggle with this problem. You've been seeking to be faithful to give away significant portions of what you earn, and yet what you discover is that the more you give, the more you get. Not as some automatic principle, not as some prosperity gospel, but it does seem that the more you give away, the more the Lord gives you to be responsible for. That is difficult. Some of us would like to have that difficulty, I suppose. But do you see my point? An enormous difficulty as you become the steward of yet more and more to give away. In the passage itself, please look with me at verse 18. Commend them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Difficult to be generous and willing to share. That's what I've just said with you. But it's also difficult to be doing good deeds. It is difficult to do good and to be rich in good deeds. And you see, the aspect of giving, of stewardship, is not only has to do with our checkbook, it has to do with our lives. The care cluster captains that stood before you, Pete, rightly said that they lead us in acts of mercy, in doing good in our neighborhoods. And what we're called upon, you see, is this. The more actually we possess monetarily, the more time and opportunity is bought for us. In other words, the more money I have, the more time and opportunity I have to use my time and my opportunity with discretion. And the challenge there is difficult. So the stewardship of money quickly becomes not only the stewardship of money itself, being generous, as he says here, but it becomes the stewardship of deeds, of doing good and being rich in good deeds. The more money, the more time, the more I have to be steward over that time. If I expend my time extravagantly on myself, then I have little time left for good deeds. And you see the difficulty that is there. It is a difficult thing to give money away. It humbles us when we think about it. Third point, money is humbling as well, because those who have a great deal of it realize its limitations. Actually, the more money you have, the more you realize its limitations. John D. Rockefeller Sr. said it well. But mark this, what I'm about ready to quote from him. He said in 1909, when he had just finished giving away $530 million. Now imagine how much $530 million would be worth in today's money. This is 1909. He gave it away, and he said this. It must always be remembered that no matter how much we give to the needs of people, there will still be more need. Very humbling. Very sobering for John Rockefeller to say that, and yet actually quite true, and keeps us from a kind of arrogance, which is the very point here that Paul is making. Do not be arrogant if you have money. Do not arrogantly use your money thinking that it's going to solve all of the problems. It's not. There's a kind of humility that must come as we contemplate the limitation of money. Secondly, money is also limited because money can actually limit our enjoyment. Hear me now, this may sound like an odd point, but I think I can prove it to you from the text. Money actually can limit our enjoyment. Look at verse 17 again. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. If you think that all of your enjoyment is dependent upon that which you provide for yourself, then you do not look to God for the provision of your enjoyment. You look to what you can earn for yourself. And if you do that, the text seems to be telling us that you're missing out on a great deal, and in fact, you might be quite poor. The idea, you see, is that if we do not allow God to be the one who gives us some enjoyment, if we think we must earn it all ourselves, if we think that all of our enjoyment of life comes from our earning of our own money, then psychologically there is an enormous shift that goes on in our heads and hearts, and I begin to focus on money as an end to my own enjoyment, and I stop focusing on God, but specifically I stop focusing on God as the one who is committed to giving me enjoyment. In other words, I look to myself and to my own resources for that enjoyment. I was trying to explain what I was going to say to Barbara early this morning, and she gave me a great passage from Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Let me just read a couple of verses from Ecclesiastes 5, verse 19, if you want to look at it later. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. It seems to me that I know many more people of quite moderate means, extreme moderate means, who have a sense of enjoyment about their life that comes from God. And yet the promise of the passage here in Timothy is that it is the wealthy who should have enjoyment, because not the poor don't, but that wealthy can have enjoyment precisely as they learn to trust in God for the giving of that which is truly enjoyable in their lives. It's a subtle point, but I think it's one that is very much worth our making together. If you think that all of your enjoyment depends upon your own acquisition of stuff to enjoy, then in the end, I don't think you will enjoy it. And here I would simply, and I hope humbly, and pointing the finger to myself, I would call to our attention the busy, frenetic lives we keep managing our stuff and managing our opportunities and managing the communication necessary to keep all of our stuff and all of our activities going. When I am driving around this city and I see a woman in a big old Suburban with a telephone, I pull over because I know that she's got a lot on her mind and she's not capable of driving that huge machine safely. Men too. Wealth needs to be used so wisely that it doesn't rob me of God's enjoyment. Very, very tricky indeed. But secondly, in this matter of of the limitations here, the limitations, our last point, the limitation of money, I want you to see that money can rob me of my future. It can rob me of my future. Look at verse 19. In this way, he's just talking about those who do good deeds, who are generous and rich in good deeds. He says, in this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. When I think about my future and money, I think about the next 20 years. I'm 50 years old. I think about 20 years out. It's about all I go. Maybe if you're a little younger, if you're 40, maybe you think 30 years. Maybe if you're a bit younger than that, you think even up to 40 years. But most of us, when we think about our future in relation to money, do you know what we think about? We think about 20, 30, 40 years. That's all. I want to propose to you that our time frame is incredibly short-sighted. And that when we think about money, we need to think about putting in the bank a savings of good deeds so that we are rich in good deeds so that, according to the text, we save up a reserve for the coming age. Which is to say that all that I am in Christ, all that I possess in Christ, all of my money and all of my time and all of the opportunity that they give me to do good, all of that actually becomes the way I put money in the bank for a future that goes way beyond 20 or 30 or 40 years. I had a wonderful illustration of this. Again, you see, it is so often those who are of more modest means who recognize this first, and they become our teachers. A number of months ago, Chris was playing in a basketball game way out in McKinney, and it was late at night. It was a late Friday night, and I was trying to get to McKinney from some weird place where I'd been somewhere else in the city of Dallas, and I was coming up an old back road, and it was totally dark. It was late at night. There was no street lights. Very narrow road, and I had a blowout in my front tire. And so I pull over, and I'm trying to figure out what to do. It's the first time I'd had a flat tire in this car. I didn't know how to change the tire. I didn't even know where the jack was. I didn't know where the spare was. So I'm pulling out the manual, and I'm trying to read it. And there's these trucks whizzing by, you know, at 70 miles an hour on this little back road. And all of a sudden, I hear this knock on my window. And I look up, and I pull my window down. And there's these two country boys there. And I look up, I see their pickup truck. I mean, these were real country boys. Help you, sir? Well, I'm just trying to change my tire. I think I can do it, thanks, you know. And they said, let us help you, you know. And I mean, in a minute and a half, it didn't take them 90 seconds. They had that tire off. They had the new tire on. I mean, bam, bam, bam. It was done, and I was on my way to the basketball game. But I tried. I tried to give them a little money. I said, can I pay you for your time and effort? And they said, oh, no, sir. No, sir. It was our privilege to do this. And I thought, money in the bank. Do you understand? They were banking. They were banking their good deeds for the coming age. I don't know whether they knew that precisely, but they were clearly putting money in the bank for the future. And why is it that people of moderate means need to teach us this? A lot of Mercedes and a lot of Cadillacs drove by me in the 10 minutes I was there. I don't know about you, but I would have driven by somebody on the side of the road. I had a place to go. I was busy. I wanted to see my son play basketball. But God has another agenda for our lives, and another agenda for our wealth, and another agenda for our time. And men and women and boys and girls, we need to figure out what that agenda is. And we need to seek to live by it. And thereby, we need to establish a great store of reserve against the coming age. There was a great epitaph on the tombstone. It went like this. What I spend, I've lost. What I've kept, I really don't have. But what I've given away, I will keep forever. And the promise here in this text is that the wealthy will come to understand that they can take hold of life that is truly life. See, the promise is to the wealthy, that they will take hold of the life that is truly life. It was William James who said that the great use of a life is to spend it on something that outlasts it. No guilt. Just the sober realization of the humility of having so much. And the great challenge that comes to us as we think how little our money can do, and yet how much we are to be the stewards of it and the time it buys.